Greetings, everyone. This is the Sound Health Radio Show with Richard Talk To Me Guy. And Sherry is, of course, off working at the soundhealthportal.com. Always amazing. I was recently attended one of her online demonstrations. And it's just amazing. A new chart. I was like, where did that come from? That's a new chart that expresses things going on in your vocal print, looking at states of imbalance. And I would suggest if you're interested in having a resource, an amazing resource online, you can go to soundhealthportal.com. And if you scroll down a bit, you'll see the current campaigns and campaigns where you can sign up for a free account and choose your campaign, and then the system will walk you through doing 2 45-second recordings. And some of the examples of campaigns, a campaign is one where you can do it for free currently. And some of the current campaigns are, for example, Corona Conflict, Stem Cells, and Neuroplasticity. Not too long ago, I was on a demo with Sherry. She said if I wanted to come in, she'd run my liver profile. I live in an agricultural area. I'm certain we'll be talking about that with Stephanie Seneff. Ag, tricky. And I just thought it would be a good idea to review. And it's really easy to have your vocal print run. Let me go back to campaigns. You sign up for a campaign. You do the 2 45-second recordings, which the system will walk you through doing right from your computer. I do recommend, and particularly since we're all Zooming like crazy now and doing online webinars and web events, investing in a Samsung Go mic. I have no vested interest. I'm just a big fan of the product. And it's a small pocket mic. It's only about 2 inches long. And it comes in a handy little case, so I always carry it with me. So that if I want to do a vocal profile from somebody on their computer, I can just plug it in and walk them through it. And it really improves the audio quality, and it's great for Zooms, because then you don't sound like you're just yelling into a can. And so you record your 2 45-second recordings. You choose the campaign that you want your vocal print run on. Vocal print just means a recording of your voice. It's run through the software. And when you submit it, within 10 hours, you'll get the results with a lot of information. I recommend sitting down with a cup of tea and reviewing the information. And then if you have a practitioner who's open to it, you could take it to them and review it with them and say, well, we might work on this, or maybe you have a subluxation, or, you know, it depends upon your practitioner. And it's really an amazing resource. And if you want to see more about the Sound Health Portal, I recommend going to Sound Health Options, scrolling to Classes, and then scroll down to Portal Presentations. And there you can choose any number of the recent or older demonstrations where Sherry's done a vocal workup online. And again, the vocal workup is taking a vocal recording, running it through the software, looking at the charts. It's really quite amazing. When you want to hear a replay of this show, you can go to soundhealthoptions.com, click on the radio tab, and go to Sound Health Radio. And at the top of that page will be the flyer for this show today and a link back to the show notes. And if you're there, if you see the link now, you can go there and you can join chat where people are typing and texting questions. And I'm putting in links and all sorts of stuff. And or if you want to listen to the show again, or share it with friends, if you click on, let's say at the top now we have icons for Stitcher or Pocket Casts. You can click on either of those. Let's say you click on Stitcher. It'll open a page with this show at the top, usually within about 20 minutes to an hour at the most. The show will appear, and you'll be able to listen to it again, and or there are on all apps, whether it be an iOS, which is called Podcasts, or Google, the default app is called Google Podcasts. In most of the podcast apps, you'll see either dots up in the upper right-hand corner or three lines called the hamburger, and you can click on those, and there'll be a share option there, and you'll be able to share the show directly from that page. And this is one of those shows with Stephanie Seneff, who I've talked to numerous times. Always an adventure. Amazing. Amazing stuff. And you'll just be able to share it and or listen to it again. And this is the kind of show we're going to talk about a lot of things in a lot of arenas. And there's a lot of information that you're going to go back and say, what did she say? What's that? It's a lot. It's really, yes. With that, Dr. Stephanie Seneff is a senior research scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She has a BS degree from MIT in biology and a PhD from MIT in electrical engineering and computer science. Her recent interests have focused on the role of toxic chemicals and micronutrient deficiencies in health and disease, with a special emphasis on the pervasive herbicide Roundup and the mineral sulfur. She's authored over 30 peer-reviewed journal papers over the past few years on these topics. Recently, she's been concentrating mainly on the relationship between nutrition and health. Since 2011, she has published over 24 papers in various medical and health-related journals on topics such as modern-day diseases, that is, Alzheimer, autism, cardiovascular disease, analysis and search of databases of drug side effects using NLP techniques and the impact of nutritional deficiencies and environmental toxins on human health. Dr. Seneff joins us to talk about possible effects of the RNA vaccine on human DNA. Welcome, Stephanie. Pardon me, I muted the wrong mic. There you are, Stephanie.
Oh, hi.
Sorry.
I'm glad to know that because you got some interesting entertainment there for a moment.
Yeah, but, well, I know. It confused me for a minute. Wait, that's not the right channel. So, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Well, as we discussed, yes, I'm good. I'll stick with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because of where we're going to go, would you please give us a clear picture of the interaction of our RNA with our DNA, because I know where we're going from there.
Right. Well, you know, it's very interesting because life is so fascinating. And we hopefully most people have learned about the basics of life, where there's the DNA code in the nucleus of the cell. And then the DNA gets transferred and translated into RNA, which is a minimal change. And then the RNA is the one that then allows it to be copied into protein, and that's where the code actually gets used. So the RNA has the same code as the DNA, but a slightly different molecule. And then the RNA, the machinery, can look at the code. It's a four-letter code, looking at it three letters at a time, and reading off each three-letter sequence and producing an amino acid. So the RNA is the one that it gets translated from into the protein. And then the proteins are the workhorses of the body. They do everything. You know, really, they're so basic to biology. So there's all the information to do all the tasks is in that RNA, which is also in the DNA. And the idea is that everything goes from DNA to RNA to protein. But what we're finding out is that's not true. Lately, there's been some amazing research that's shown that the RNA can go back to DNA. And actually, it's been known for quite some time. Even when I was in college, actually, I spent 1 year in David Baltimore's lab. He later won the Nobel Prize for the work that was going on there, and that work was involving retroviruses. And so you probably know Judy Mikovits. She's been really outspoken about the danger of this vaccine that we're being subjected to, she thinks. And the claim is that the RNA is very safe because it's not DNA, and therefore it can't possibly get back into our genome. But you have to be very careful with that because there is, for example, HIV, AIDS, that virus is a retrovirus. And that's Judy Mikovits' expertise is in retroviruses. And retroviruses, retro is reverse. And what that means is they have the skill to convert RNA back into DNA. And even that DNA can become integrated in our own genome. And in fact, some 10% of our genome is known to be derived from retroviruses. And in fact, I think viruses are actually the agents, the primary agents of evolution. I think that almost has to be true. And I think we're starting to realize that that's the case. We think of viruses as bad bugs that are going to cause trouble. There are so many viruses out there. And most of them are benign and, in fact, essential to life. I think they're sort of the mechanism by which all life forms are able to evolve, and especially to evolve rapidly under conditions of stress. And certainly we are under conditions of stress right now with all the chemicals that we're exposed to. And I think that's a reason why we've had so much trouble recently with this emergence of these new viruses that are making people very sick. The viruses are actually working very hard to try to figure out how to redesign. This is what I believe. Ultimately, they want to redesign how we work so that we can get around the damage that is being done to us by these chemicals. It's a very, very challenging task before them. And they can't get it right immediately. They have to play around with different ideas. And in the meantime, they're going to make us sick. And it's just, you have to, through trial and error, eventually reach some place, probably not possible to reach some place where you can be healthy in the environment we're in right now because of all these toxic chemicals that we're exposed to. So the viruses have an enormous task these days because humans have basically spilled all these poisons all over the world. And they're not up to that task. They're trying, but they're failing, basically, is the way I see it. And so we're facing the consequences of our poisons, which is that we get this virus that's spreading throughout humanity all over the world and causing serious disease among people who, I think, it's among the people who have been poisoned more. So the ones who are living a healthy life, I think they're going to be okay with this virus. The ones that are being exposed to poisons are not.
And how we'll get back to total toxic load in a little bit. But first, I want to ask about, I saw a post that you'd, an article, or I can't remember right now, but an article or research that you had posted on Facebook talking about potential issues of the mRNA and how it could indeed, this is all my languaging, everybody, Stephanie will make it clear, could potentially corrupt our RNA. And would you talk about that?
Okay. What? All right. Yeah. I am absolutely fascinated by this. I love science. I love biology, especially. And I'm like a kid in a candy store these days because you discover all these new things that you didn't even know to look for before. But once you say, "Oh my God, what is this vaccine and what is it doing exactly?" And then, "Oh, what are the implications of that?" And when you start asking those questions and looking through the research literature to answer them, you go, "Oh my God." I mean, you really have to go, "Oh my God," I think, because what I realized, I knew about retroviruses like HIV, and I knew they could convert RNA into DNA. And I was suspecting that DNA could end up in our genome over time, eventually. What I didn't know until recently is that our own cells also can also convert RNA into DNA. They have the same tool. And it's usually quiet. I mean, most cells don't express it. That means they don't really produce that protein or that RNA. It actually is like 10%. 20% of our genome is devoted to these units called LINE lines. And that stands for long interspersed nuclear elements, long interspersed nuclear elements line. And they're so fascinating. And so there's a line one, which is the one that's mostly active in human cells. And it's only active, it's active particularly during fertilization. And especially the sperm express it during fertilization, which is so fascinating. I found a couple of really interesting articles where they have shown specifically that when you expose sperm to what they call exogenous RNA. So what that is RNA that's not human RNA, came from someplace else, such as a virus or such as a vaccine, like these RNA vaccines, which of course at that time didn't exist. But you've got external RNA. The sperm takes up that RNA. The sperm converts it into DNA, and it's a circular DNA. It puts it inside these little pellets. And then at the time of fertilization, and is that my impression is basically there's all these sperm, right, trying to get to the egg, and they all are able to release these little pellets of RNA that's been converted into DNA, and then they're taken up by the fertilized egg. The fertilized egg absorbs all of these little pellets with this code inside them that is foreign RNA. And then the amazing thing is that RNA converted to DNA then stays in the embryo. It gets propagated into all the cells of the fetus and the infant, and that infant grows up and continues to carry this DNA and able to use this DNA to make that protein that's inside there, that is to say, make the spike protein. So in theory, We have all the resources in our bodies to take the vaccine's RNA, convert it into DNA, and then have a baby be born that can, for its entire life, make spike protein. And then not only that, but that child, when it grows up, can actually pass that information on to the next generation. So it's an epigenetic effect. It hasn't gone into the actual nucleus, you know, the nuclear DNA of our genome, but it's in the cell and it's able to produce protein, namely the spike protein, because that's what's in that vaccine. So to have, and if you picture an infant then, and the other thing is that when they do that, if that fetus is exposed to that in utero, then it doesn't know that that's foreign. It thinks of it as something that's native. So it doesn't react to that spike protein the normal way. It doesn't produce antibodies. And what I think that can mean is that that person who is this child that's inherited this RNA is going to be able to be a super carrier of the disease, because it will be able to, if it gets infected, it's like spike protein says, oh yeah, that's native. I don't care about that. I'm not going to even react. I'm not going to make any antibodies. And then the virus will be able to thrive and probably not even cause disease, because it's the immune response that's causing all the symptoms. So that child is happy with this protein. It looks like it's native and it's fine. And it just goes ahead and produces that virus and then becomes a super spreader for its entire life. That is possible, I think. And in fact, we have evidence of something like that happening in cattle. And I had remembered reading about this many years ago, and I dug it back up again recently. I found an amazing article about this virus that cows get. And apparently it's a pretty serious problem among herds of cattle, and also other ungulates like sheep and even the elk and the deer, the wild animals that are ungulates. It's an ungulate, it's a virus that infects ungulates. And it's called bovine viral diarrhea virus, BVDV, bovine diarrhea virus. And that virus, what this article that I read was just incredible, because it talked about these calves that were being born with a virus. They'd been exposed to the virus in utero, and then they were born with the virus essentially integrated into their own, you know, genetic makeup, so that they didn't think it was a foreign thing. And then those calves that had that problem would infect the entire herd. And the article talked about the way to control this virus is to identify those calves that have this feature and kill them, you know, prune them from the cull of the herd, take away those calves because they're going to infect the rest of the herd, and kill them, was the solution that they were proposing in this article. So that was just absolutely amazing to me, because when you think about that happening with that virus, I can't think of a good reason why it wouldn't happen with this vaccine. And that's what's got me really quite concerned.
And I want to back up for a minute to total toxic load. So if a child, let's say the mother is carrying a child, and the mother lives in a tropical place and eats organic food as a lifestyle, and the kids are playing in the dirt and have a strong immune system and all that. Mm-hmm. When that child's born, is it any more resistant to that kind of what I will call pollution? Or is a strong immune system not any kind of defense to what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's a good question. A strong innate immune system is essential for being able to resist this virus. And I believe that anyone who has a strong innate immune system is not going to get sick with this virus. At the most, they might get a cold. You know, it would be a very minimal disease if their innate immune system is strong. The problem, I believe, is that the chemicals are destroying our innate immune system. Particularly, I think glyphosate is destroying our innate immune system. And I actually have a book underway, which is will be published hopefully in June of this year, June 2, 2021, will come out, called Toxic Legacy, and it's going to be all about glyphosate. I have a whole chapter in there arguing my position for why I think glyphosate is going to cause us to be unable to fight off disease easily, to direct those cells that are involved with protecting us from viruses and other bacteria and whatnot. Fungi, the whole works. And the thing is that if you have a strong innate immune system, the virus comes into your lungs and you just wipe it out immediately. You don't even give it a chance to reproduce, and you don't even have to make antibodies. You can clear it all, you know, the innate immune system can clear it all by itself without even causing cytokine storm, which is how you get these symptoms. You know, like you get local tissue destruction because you've turned on the adaptive immune system under the condition where your innate immune system is weak. And so, and that is under the condition where you've been poisoned by these various chemicals. And so it's the adaptive immune system that causes the disease symptoms. And it's also the adaptive immune system that produces the antibodies. And the antibodies can become autoantibodies. This is something I'm very concerned about because the autoantibodies then can attack your own tissues and cause autoimmune disease. And we have had an increasing load of autoimmune disease over the past at least 20 years. Our a number of people suffering from various autoimmune diseases is going up and up. And I think that, again, is due to the fact that our innate immune system is too weak. And so when we get something, we're confronted with some kind of a foreign, invasion of something like viruses or bacteria or fungi, then we can't fight them off without invoking these antibodies, which makes it much easier to see them then. So the antibodies are kind of putting a red light on all the viruses so that the immune cells can find them, because the immune cells are essentially blind without the antibodies because they're broken by the chemicals. This is what I think is going on. And so actually there was a study on the spike protein. The spike protein is the protein that the RNA codes for in the RNA vaccines. I don't know if your audience understands these RNA vaccines, but the vaccine is quite amazing. It's a technology that they've been developing for a long time. And I have to say, they're very excited about this technology because they believe it's a way that you can introduce new information into cells. You know, for example, if someone has a defect, like a defective protein, because they have a genetic mutation, in theory, you could put in the RNA for a good version of that protein. You could use it as a vaccine to let their body have a new version of that protein that's healthy. And that sounds very appealing, you know, to be able to replace their broken protein with a working version of it. And they also are envisioning this technology to be very useful for fighting cancer, where you can actually have RNA in there that's targeted towards cancer cells. It will take it up and then turn it into something that will actually cause the cancer cell to die. So they're very, very excited about this technology. And I think they're probably really delighted at the way things have turned out in some weird way, because this pandemic gives them the opportunity to kind of jump into this space in a big hurry. And I just find it extraordinary that they think it's okay to just toss this vaccine into the entire world population and not expect some kind of effect that we haven't had no clue about, because it's such new technology and it's so exotic and so far away from anything else we've done before. And to think that there aren't some kind of consequences that we're not aware of that are going to happen is just mind-boggling to me, to think that it's safe to do this on such a grand scale. I'm very worried about that. I mean, we can hope everything's going to go great and there actually won't be that many people who actually have the exact conditions where, I mean, you could argue that everything will be fine. Maybe a few people will be harmed and it won't be too bad. You know, that's what they're saying, right? I'm just very worried. I just think it's way too rushed and extraordinary, too, that it was done so fast. Normally, vaccines take many more years to develop, and to rush through a vaccine that's a brand new technology and just put it out there and let the world's population be the guinea pigs. I don't even understand how they can think that that's okay, you know?
Well, I was going to save this for later, but it's going to make me dive into the 1986 law and ask you about waving your magic wand and making that law go away. Could you talk about the 1986 law?
Yes, I mean, that was really, the beginning of the disaster that's been vaccines since then, because right before 1986, actually, there was a lot of trouble with the DPT shot. That's a shot that had aluminum in it, and a lot of people were getting really bad side effects, and people were thinking it was causing autism. It was really, I remember, actually, my youngest son was due for his, I vaccinated all my kids, but my youngest son was due for his DPT shot. And I had a friend whose son got the DPT shot and ran a very high fever, piercing cry. A week later, he developed seizures, and then he was diagnosed with autism. And so when I went for the DPT shot, I said to my doctor, I won't let him get that shot. I don't want you to give him that shot. And the doctor was very compliant. He said, oh, that's fine. You know, I think it's going to be removed from the market anyway very shortly because they're having so much trouble with it. So he didn't put up a fight at all, and my son didn't get it. And then And then it was a few years later, that was about 1984 probably. So just a couple of years later, we got that law. So the vaccine industry basically said, you know what, we're not going to make these vaccines if we have to cope with all these lawsuits we're going to get. We can't afford that. It won't be worth it for us. We're just going to take them down. And the government's like, no, you can't not have vaccines. And so the government was willing to come in and say, okay, we'll take the burden of the lawsuits. We'll do that. That'll be on our head. The company gets a get out of jail free card, doesn't have to worry about anything that goes wrong. And once you are in that situation, the company, when they do the whole vaccine trials, they're very loosey-goosey about it, the way compared to what they would do with a drug trial, because with a drug, they're going to get lawsuits, you know, and they've had some nasty problems with some drugs that they didn't check out well enough during the process and ended up causing something that unanticipated, and they got a bunch of lawsuits. That's happened with many drugs. That doesn't happen with the vaccine because the law protects them from it. And therefore, they don't care if the vaccine is causing something that could cause damage. It's not going to hurt them financially. And that makes them much more casual about the testing process before they release the vaccine. And then the same thing with this vaccine. I think with this emergency, the vaccine has not been approved. This mRNA vaccine has not been approved in the general sense of the word. It's only approved for emergency use. And again, the companies are off the hook. You know, if anything goes wrong, it's not their problem. And so this is a field day for them. They're so delighted. They're going to make a ton of money off of this vaccine. All the companies that are able to produce a vaccine, they're going to just, be filthy rich, basically, without worries.
Yeah. And one of the things about the 86 law made it so that if somebody did want to sue, they go before this board.
Yes.
And the moment you go to the board, vaccine court, yeah, there's a baseball cap I'd like to wear. And you sign a document that's a non-disclosure document. So you might get a settlement, and yet you can't say anything in the world or you'll lose your money. So there's no ability for us to know what's going on. So it makes the pharmaceutical companies for vaccines completely non-liable, non-responsible. So it blows my mind. It just blows my mind.
And what amazes me is that the population is content to just let this happen. I mean, people should be very aware of these so many cases of parents who had a child perfectly fine. The child got the shot. They had a very bad reaction to the shot, and then they got sick after that, you know, and they never recovered. And very sick, you know, things like autism or even in some cases death. And nasty stuff. The HPV vaccine is one that I've been very upset about. This one for the girls to protect them from cervical cancer some 40, 50 years later. That's so ridiculous. They have never proven that the vaccine even protects you from cancer. And actually, the evidence looks like it may cause you to get cancer because it kills off there's several strains. It's like over 100 strains of HPV, and the vaccine only matches a few of them. And so once you sort of get rid of those guys, then there's other strains that might be more virulent that come into play. They get an open space because the competition has been cleared out by the vaccine. And so you can get cervical cancer from a more vicious version of that same HPV virus as a consequence of being vaccinated against it. That's what happens with the flu too. You know, we always talk about how the flu shot didn't match well this year, you know, because we picked the wrong strains. We're always trying to figure out which strains are strong each year and design the vaccine anew. And then, of course, you've got to get a new vaccine every year because the strains have changed. And we're probably sort of chasing our tail because we're killing off certain species certain strains of the flu vaccine. We basically suppress those with the vaccine, and then the other strains are there ready to go. And so you can't win that game. You know, you can't win it. And I think it's kind of crazy with the flu where they're telling you every time you turn around, go get your flu shot, you know, and we've got more flu. I think we're not making any headway against the flu with all these shots. We used to have only the old people got the shot. Now you've got even the pregnant women are getting the flu shot. Never mind that there's, you know, mercury in it, right? A lot of the flu shots have mercury in them. No problem for the baby. I mean, that's just insane.
And I want to jump back for a minute and talk about something like polio. That's sort of the poster child for, look, we eliminated polio by vaccinations.
Right.
And yet, the sort of another side of that is last year, I interviewed Dr. William Gifford, who's an MD, who's 98, and he had polio, and he had polio as a child in his late teens. And I can't remember exactly how he was brought to this doctor, but there was a doctor, Dr. Klenner, who did research in vitamin C, and he was clearing young people of polio by giving them 100,000 units of grams of vitamin C IV on a repetitive basis for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I have so many bad words I'd like to use, but I can't. It really irritates me that none of the talking heads talk about, like, supporting an immune system. Nobody's out there saying, what about eating an organic diet, or how about taking vitamin C?
I'm so angry with them for not saying that. I can't tell you how angry I am.
Because it's not, that part isn't that hard. What about having a good immune system?
Right?
Could we talk about that? Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. We should shout at each other, but that has just infuriated me that they don't say anything in the media or in the government. Nobody's saying anything about just eating healthy, living healthy, getting sunlight exposure so you've got your vitamin D up. I mean, people with low vitamin D have a fourfold increased risk of dying from COVID-19. And, you know, also all the different, they have all these cofactors, all these different chronic diseases that if you're obese, if you have diabetes, if you have a high blood pressure, you know, all these diseases that are associated with bad outcomes with COVID-19. And those diseases are all going up in our population exactly in step with the rise in glyphosate usage on core crops, you know. So I think actually those diseases are an indicator of glyphosate poisoning, and it's glyphosate that's the reason why people are having a bad effect, a bad reaction to the virus. And it's really amazing when you look at the difference in the death rate among different countries. You know, look at the country level, look at Taiwan versus the United States. You know, I think Taiwan, last time I checked, and it's been true for a long time, 7 deaths in the entire country from COVID-19 in Taiwan. You know, incredibly good record. And Taiwan uses way less glyphosate than we do. They don't allow GMOs. You know, then they have really healthy food. I've been there for extended periods of time, and you know, their food is fantastic. And they've got a lot of fermented foods, and everything's fresh vegetables. You know, lightly cooked, excellent fats. I mean, it's just really, really good food, and they don't get sick with COVID. You know, they don't die. So here we just can't control this infection. It just keeps going up and up. I mean, I guess it is starting to turn the corner now, I hope. It looks like it's starting to come down, which is hopeful. I think we're not going to get over this this virus until we've got everybody, you know, exposed. So those people who are healthy, they don't have anything to worry about, the ones who have a healthy immune system. The ones who don't, I mean, they should really get into the program of eating the organic diet and getting out in the sunlight, you know, and eating fermented foods. I mean, these are all easy things to do. The vitamin C, so eating foods that are rich in vitamin C and vitamin K2, and then getting out in the sunlight to get your vitamin D. Those three are really, really important. All studies have shown that a deficiency in any of those three is linked to poor outcomes with COVID-19. And the government knows, they should know this. It's published literature. You know, it's not like something that isn't known. And I don't know why they don't say it. I just really boggles the mind that they're only talking about social distancing and face masks and vaccines, you know, like that's the only solution. And yet you can compare us to countries like Taiwan where, you know, it's a healthy living is just going to keep people from getting sick.
I just had an image of the government mailing everybody a bottle of vitamin C. Let's just start there. Just take 3 grams a day. Maybe just 3 grams a day. Let's not, scare you. Just any number of things. And I also think of Dr. Paul Harch, MD, and I think he's in Louisiana, who is one of the thought leaders on hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Mm-hmm. And he spoke about, I've interviewed him a number of times, but he spoke about when we had the flu back in 1918, one of the things that they used then was a form of hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And for new listeners, HBO, or hyperbaric oxygen therapy, is pressurized, high-quality, clean oxygen. You put in a tank. It's basically diving tanks, but a more high-tech version. a cleaner version. And you go into a tank and you lay in this pressurized oxygen so that your tissues become oxygenated. And you it has just a myriad of results. I had interviewed his mentor years ago, who was the Dr. Neubauer, brought it to ICUs for stroke patients, because if you get it, the sooner you get a stroke patient into an HBO tank, the faster they recover. And
that's
so Dr. Harch was observing that the 1918 flu, they were using a kind of hyperbaric oxygen tank. I don't think they were using medical grade oxygen, but they were pressurizing oxygen, and people had a good recovery rate.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's trying to do research, and he's been using HBO for decades, trying to get research to go, you know, if you put people into an HBO tank instead of putting them on a ventilator, they're not going to have a bronchial irritation from the air blowing into the lung on a regular basis and drying out the mucosa. This is all my opinion. You would actually get oxygen pressurized into the body, help the mitochondria, help people recur. I mean, it's all mind-blowing. I don't have, there's no question there. I don't have that in the form of a question. I'm sorry.
Right. Well, I actually have something to say about that, because it's quite interesting that what the virus does. And I've been studying, exactly the sequence of events that happens in these cases where things go south. And it's really quite fascinating, because the virus, launches this whole cascade reaction of the body. The body's immune system responds with this reaction that involves recruiting a whole bunch of immune cells, things like macrophages come into the lungs, and then the blood becomes leaky, like the blood opens up and allowing those macrophages to get in, but also allowing water to get in. So the blood sort of gets into the, not the blood, but the water from the blood gets into the lung tissue. And even there are enzymes that get activated that actually make water and to produce this. And then they also make something called hyaluronic acid. There's an upregulation of a production of a protein called hyaluronic acid, which actually traps water and makes gelled water. And so it's really wild, all the things that are going on in the lungs of these patients, and that you end up it's almost like drowning, right? People feel like they're drowning because they've got all this gelled water in the alveoli, which are those places that are supposed to be sockets of air providing the oxygen to the lungs. So when you fill up those alveoli with gelled water, then you really have a oxygen deficit problem. And then that triggers another reaction that causes an enzyme called heme oxygenase to be made. And that is breaking down heme and turning it into biliverdin, also making water. So there's these things there are these enzymes that are reacting and pulling hydrogens out of molecules and turning them into water. And that water is actually very special water. It's water that I would call deuterium depleted water. It's water that's low in deuterium, because these enzymes are able to select for hydrogen over deuterium. Deuterium is heavy hydrogen. And there's absolutely fascinating biology around deuterium that I've been reading about over the past year. It's so, so interesting. It turns out that the mitochondria hate deuterium. Deuterium is a natural heavy hydrogen atom. It has an extra neutron, which makes it twice as heavy as the hydrogen atom, which is the tiniest atom on the planet. Hydrogen is very tiny. Most of our body is hydrogen. We have 99% of our molecules in our body, of our atoms in our body, are hydrogen atoms. Really amazing. And the hydrogen atoms, then we have a number of deuterium atoms that is much smaller, but still very large compared to even something like calcium. So there's a lot of deuterium around. The hyaluronic acid makes the gelled water that traps deuterium. And then these enzymes that are invoked by the virus make deuterium depleted water. So you have this rich source of deuterium depleted water in the interstitial spaces of the lungs. And the macrophages swarm in there, and they're basically drinking that water. There's something called macropinocytosis, which it means big drink cell. So a cellular big drink. So they sweep up that deuterium depleted water, and they deliver it to their mitochondria to make them healthy. So the problem, I think, is a systemic problem with excess deuterium in the mitochondria that causes mitochondrial disease. So the mitochondria are not working well. And you can help to repair the mitochondria through this really elegant process that practically kills the patient, because there's not enough oxygen getting supplied. And as long as your problem is fixable, you can actually restore the mitochondrial health to these macrophages, which then allows them to clear the virus. So it's a whole bootstrapping method by which the virus is providing the reaction in the body that allows the macrophages to become healthy so that they can clear the virus. And so if all goes well, you have this sort of panic phase of not being able to breathe and feeling like you're not getting enough air. But in the end, you fix the macrophages, you clear the virus, and then you heal. And what you've done is you've strengthened your innate immune system when you're done. The problem is that we're so sick that it just goes way too far, and we end up killing ourselves with this virus because our macrophages are so sick that the virus's capacity is not strong enough to actually carry out the task sufficiently well to not accidentally kill the patient at the same time.
And in that case, do you think that if the patient was getting hyperbaric oxygen therapy, that would help them stay oxygenated while the body went through that process?
Yeah, I think if they are in a situation where this virus has caused such an intense reaction that they can't get enough oxygen, that this can make it easier oxygen access to keep them alive, to be able to push through that enough to give them just enough extra oxygen to get through it, I think it would be beneficial for those extreme patients.
Right. And so back to total toxic load, if a person had a good immune system to begin with, good blood sugars, good solid diet, vitamin C in your foods or in fermented foods and all that, do you think we can get this and come out the other end actually slightly stronger from passing through having that illness and having the body's own antibodies build up to be further resistant to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question to ask, and I don't know the answer, of course. I can only guess, but I do believe that if you are infected with this virus and you are healthy, you may end up with a latent version of the virus just hanging around in your cells, and it will only come into play under conditions where you're being poisoned. So I think that I'm imagining that this virus will be able to settle into, basically, it's sort of populating the entire humanity, all of humanity is being populated by this virus right now. And those people who don't have symptoms, they might end up with the virus kind of in very small numbers, just kind of being sitting there waiting for a possible time when they're needed. And then the virus can actually then, cause what might be called a flare-up, where, and maybe it would be even so slight you wouldn't notice it, but they would actually be able to keep those mitochondria of the macrophages happy by these kind of very low level activities of the sort I just described, so low level you don't really feel sick. But the macrophages then have an opportunity to maintain healthy mitochondria despite being exposed periodically to low levels of poison. So the whole thing is that the ones who are being exposed to high levels of poison chronically, their macrophages are so sick they can't really take advantage of the situation without it becoming so extreme that the patient dies. So there's a game to be played. I have to say, there's a very interesting observation that I made about Africa. You probably know that Africa has a much, much lower rates of COVID problems than we do here in the United States. In fact, the countries that are being hit the hardest by COVID are pretty much countries that use a lot of glyphosate. You've got Brazil. Brazil's a very heavy user of glyphosate. And South Africa is the one that uses the most by far in all of Africa. And they have the worst outbreak of COVID-19 in Africa. And then if U.S., of course, and Canada, and then U.K., U.K. uses a lot of glyphosate. They have a very overrun with COVID-19. And most of Europe is in trouble, and they use a lot of glyphosate. Even though they're mostly non-GMO, they mostly don't allow GMOs, but they still use a lot of glyphosate. And so I think the countries that are using a lot of glyphosate are the ones that are having a hard time, struggling with COVID-19. I really think it's a major player in controlling the degree to which the country is susceptible. Because once you've got a person who has a weak immune system, actually there was an amazing paper that I read about a case study of a person in the UK who had cancer. He had cancer. He was being treated with an immune suppressing drug. So when you've got cancer, you've got immune suppressing drugs, you've got a weak immune system for sure. And this person got sick with COVID-19 under this circumstance in the hospital. And they gave him remdesivir, that's sort of a drug that they find is effective. And then they gave him two rounds of plasma from people who had recovered from COVID-19, and they were giving them antibodies that those people had produced against the. So they were feeding this guy antibodies against the virus, trying to get the virus, you know, to get controlled, and that didn't have, you know, they kept him alive for 101 days in the hospital, and the entire time he was shedding. So they had him in an isolation room with, you know, they set up this air flow so that his room where he wasn't. They were trying to keep his spread within his room and really keeping him in isolation. For 101 days, he was shedding the virus and potentially spreading it. And by the end of that 101 days when he died, they looked at the virus, they analyzed the virus that he was carrying. And by that point, it had already mutated to, like, there were like over a dozen different mutations in the virus, particularly in that spike protein, mutations in the spike protein, that led to a very different version of the virus by that time. And the authors hypothesized that that he was the virus was mutating in response to the antibodies and managed to weasel its way out of the antibodies. So the ones that were surviving, this is survival of the fittest, the versions of the virus that were surviving were the ones that were not, couldn't be trapped by that by the antibodies. And so this kind of situation, when you have somebody who has a weak immune system who gets the virus and then is delivered antibodies from other people, then that virus is their virus in their body is going to learn how to get around those antibodies and become resistant to the antibodies. And I think this is what's going to happen with the vaccine, unfortunately, is that we're already seeing like this new strain from the UK. There's one from South Africa. There's one in Brazil. I mean, these are all countries that are heavy users of glyphosate, and they've all got these new strains of the virus that are have had many, many different mutations, not just a couple, in the spike protein, allowing it to reshape itself so that it doesn't respond to the antibodies that are normally produced to the original version of the virus. And so when you expose people to the vaccine, it's stuck in that version that is the old version of the virus, and you're going to develop antibodies to the wrong thing, and then they won't work with the virus that's out there in the world. So when you have even just one person who has a weak immune system who catches COVID, and then the virus just multiplies like crazy in their body, and then they're spreading it to everybody they come in contact with, when you have people like that in your community, it's very, very hard to contain that virus. It's much, much worse. I mean, just face masks is not going to be enough in that situation. You know, whereas if you have people who immediately they get the virus, it goes away, the virus can't spread. So it really makes a huge difference when you have a bunch of people in your community that have a weak immune system. It makes a huge difference in the degree to which the virus spreads. And these people who wrote about this case, they suspected that the strain that showed up in the UK with all these mutations was a consequence of another person like that. They were suspecting, they were predicting that could be the case. You know, it's a hypothesis. But that's really quite disturbing, you know, to think about.
And I want to jump back in time to when I was a kid, we got measles.
And I got measles too.
I was of the generation where when you heard that one of your family friends had measles, you went over and like rubbed up against them so you could get measles too.
Mm-hmm.
that was the idea. Is mm-hmm. that we all got measles together. We all had a couple of weeks off. We all thought, yay, we're on vacation. We have measles. And it was
that was
bad. It was annoying.
We had eight kids in my family. We all, five of us got it at the same time, the five oldest kids. We all got the measles at the same time. I remember playing a lot of Monopoly games. We had a great time. I had a few bumps on my belly, but I didn't even feel sick. You know, I was fine.
Exactly.
It was kind of great to have a two-week vacation from school. It was a thrill.
Is one of the variables from everything that we've talked about, and you and I have talked before numerous times about glyphosate, is one of the possible variables that we have such a toxic load now in the environment, glyphosate and everything else that's happening, that was different when we were kids, that we didn't have glyphosate?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, is that one of the considerations or things?
Yeah,
or
well,
I don't
actually,
know what to call
you know,
that.
Polio, as you probably know, there are many people who think polio was really caused by the DDT. That the paralytic polio, the virus didn't cause paralysis before DDT, and then it disappeared after DDT was banned. It disappeared in timing with the vaccine, so they could give the vaccine credit, but it was already disappearing as they were phasing out DDT. The virus was the polio was disappearing. You know, the paralysis, and so people have said that that. The vaccine got credit for what was really a DDT story, that it was the banning of DDT that actually was what solved the paralytic polio problem. And, you know, they just basically have, they have a way of saying the vaccine is doing all the good stuff. And then when somebody dies right after they get a vaccine, it's just coincidental, you know. It's just kind of interesting how things get spun different ways, depending upon the messaging and what you want people to believe.
Well, in a certain way,
talk about, Africa.
Go ahead, please
that
do.
Was very interesting,
yeah,
with Africa. And I got off on a tangent there, but tuberculosis is a problem all over the world, but there's certain countries where it's much worse than certain other countries, and it's a major infective disease that kills. I mean, it's no picnic, but it turns out in Africa, 80% of the people in Africa actually harbor the bacterium that causes tuberculosis. And Mycobacterium tuberculosis, it's called. And that 80% of people have it, but most of those people don't experience any symptoms. So this is, again, the case. If you've got a strong immune system, you can just carry this bacterium and it's not going to cause you any harm. And in fact, I think that bacterium is protective against COVID-19, because I found a color-coded map of Africa showing, you know, colors that would have high versus low levels of tuberculosis in those different countries. And then another map of Africa showing high versus low death rates from COVID-19. And you look at those two maps side by side and you can see they're a mirror image of each other. The places where tuberculosis is endemic had low COVID, and the places where tuberculosis was low had high COVID. It was an exact mirror image. It was so fascinating, which makes me think that the tuberculosis infection, latent tuberculosis infection, sits there in the lungs and produces useful stuff that keeps the lungs, keeps the macrophages healthy by supplying this whole process of keeping them, their mitochondria healthy by producing certain proteins or different kinds of products from those bacteria that are healthy, that are promoting health. And so when you have that infection with the bacteria, it keeps your immune cells healthy, and therefore you are resistant to COVID-19. So in other words, and in fact, you know, it's been shown with diseases like measles and mumps. There's studies that are amazing that have shown that if people who caught measles, natural measles in childhood, have remarkable protection against things like heart disease and cancer later in life. You know, it's a protection that lasts lifelong protection from some of these chronic diseases as a consequence of catching the measles as a child or the mumps. So we really don't understand viruses, but I think they're doing something. Most of the time, they're doing something good and useful and powerful. And then it's just that every once in a while, we get into a situation, usually because of too much toxic chemical exposure, where they cause a huge amount of trouble. You know, it's really the chemicals that are the problem, not the virus.
Well, and one of my other, I'll call it a pet peeve, is that I'm a fan of fever. Fever is an indicator. Fever has function in the body. And we got into this technological revolution where fever was suddenly the enemy. Like, oh my God, you have a fever. Take aspirin. Quick, stop it. And
I
yes,
know.
Fever can be dangerous, but it has function. It's a built-in thing that the body does to try and cook things off in a certain very crude way. You'll have a much better way of saying it. But would you talk about fever a little bit?
I will, because I found something really, really fascinating. I found an article about viruses and deuterium. And deuterium has been my thing lately, so I've really been studying deuterium. But it's very interesting because viruses, of course, respond to fever. Fever, it's right at that temperature threshold between normal temperature and fever that the viruses start to fall apart. Like the fever can actually break the viruses. But, you know, they are, as you know, RNA is very unstable. And so these viruses become susceptible to high temperature. It can cause them to, it basically kills them. And it turns out that if they've got enough deuterium in the virus actually traps deuterium. And if it has enough deuterium, it becomes resistant to fever. It can stay, it doesn't fall apart until a higher temperature. So it can be resistant to fever, which I find really, really fascinating, because then the virus is part of the task of pulling the deuterium out of the water. So you have that beautiful deuterium depleted water that's left over. The virus is sucking up the deuterium, and the hyaluronic acid is sucking up the deuterium into the gelled water that's in those alveoli. And that's leaving behind deuterium depleted water in the lungs, in the interstitial spaces where the macrophages come in and drink that water and fix their mitochondria. So I think that's really, really fascinating. It's an idea that of what to explain why the virus does what it does in the lungs, and so just interesting biology, in my opinion. But I was really amazed to see that these viruses are actually stabilized. Their RNA is stabilized by deuterium.
Wow. Wow. And it's back to, I'm surprised we're coming around the bend to the end of the show, but really I want to go back to the thing we've talked about, glyphosate. That's one of the toxins. I'm old enough that as a kid, as we were driving the Salinas Valley to visit my grandparents up in what is now the Silicon Valley, I would stick my head out of the window because it was cool to get dusted with moisture from the crop duster. And it wasn't until decades later that I realized, oh, that was probably DDT, because it was a cool thing to drive through the Salinas Valley and see the crop dusters
literally
out there spraying spray. And it was of the time zone when it would have been DDT.
Right.
And so we seem to be going out of our way. I mean, our usage, I don't know, I wasn't going to go here, but is there any reason why? I mean, I read something recently where Mexico is now going to stop using glyphosate.
I know. I'm so glad to hear that because that's very close to home.
Right. And why do we – is it just money that the United States just can't give it up? It's like a bad drug.
I know. We have become so dependent on glyphosate. You know, we have all these GMO crops, and also we're spraying the non-GMO crops right before harvest, like wheat and oats. I mean, and all the chickpeas and garbanzo beans, they're all highly contaminated with glyphosate. The government really wants to believe what the industry is telling them, that this is a wonderful herbicide. It's practically non-toxic to humans, but it kills all plants except those that have been engineered to resist it. Wonderful, wonderful herbicide. You know, what's not to love about it? And there's no reason why we shouldn't just keep on doing it. It's making our food very cheap, you know. And of course, it's doing a lot of bad things. It's destroying the microbes in the soil, and so it's causing our a lot of problems with the plants become less resistant to fungus and less resistant to disease of any sort. Actually, water, they suffer drought more easily. I mean, it really weakens the plants, the glyphosate does. Even the ones that are GMOs, they get weakened by the glyphosate. So you have and of course they're also, the weeds are developing resistance to glyphosate, which is one of the reasons why the usage keeps going up. They have to hit it harder with more glyphosate to kill the weed as the weeds evolve to be resistant. And so it's almost become to the point now where glyphosate's not really worth it anymore. They've started introducing these other chemicals, like, you know, 2,4-D is coming back, and dicamba and glufosinate. These are all also very toxic chemicals that are being added, you know, to the glyphosate, because the glyphosate alone is not good enough to kill the weeds anymore. It's just going to be further nightmare with different kinds of diseases we're going to get from these other chemicals that are now becoming part of our food supply. It's a hopeless, endless failure that we're going to see in the years to come. We're just going to get sicker and sicker, and we have to just simply wake up and realize we can't keep doing it this way. I really love the young folks who've decided they're going to go buy a plot of land, grow, have a small organic farm. That's the answer, the solution for a healthy future. There's no other solution, in my opinion, other than to take the young people back to the farm, go back to having the small organic that are producing all kinds of different, you know, vegetables and fruits and whatnot. And get rid of these mega farms that are based on chemical-based agriculture. It's just not working. We have to recognize that fact. And then the government needs to take the lead in making that happen. I don't know what it's going to take to get them to realize that. But, you know, this virus is probably going to accelerate their – I hope it's going to cause people to be more aware of the need to do this because of the virus. That might be a silver lining.
That would be – I put this in quotes because it sounds spooky for me to say. That would be great if the hashtag thanks COVID, if this creates. I'm not saying it justifies it in any way. It's a horrible situation. However, if it gets us to pay attention to, as you talk about plants, as being an old school herbalist, and knowing people who've been growing permaculture, biodynamic, all those magic words now that really was just organic farming for decades.
Yes.
Growing plants where they're getting them tested, and then they find out they have glyphosate in it, and they've never had glyphosate on their land.
Yeah, that's
because it's in the water table. I live in a part of California in Sonoma County where it's a huge wine industry, and I know people vineyards that have been growing permaculture biodynamic wine for decades, and now their wines are testing and having traces of glyphosate. They've never applied glyphosate anywhere on their land. Hundreds of acres.
That's so frustrating.
And it's because it's leaching into the water table, and it's showing up in breast milk, and it's everywhere. It's just at some point it seems like we have to go, wow, maybe that's not good. You and I have talked about it enough, but I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know how the government can think that it's not causing trouble when you see, especially those stunning correlations. You know, Nancy Swanson's a friend of mine. She did that paper where she had like 30 graphs and all these diseases going up exactly in step with glyphosate. And then they just dismiss it and say, oh, correlation doesn't mean causation. And that's the end of that. I mean, it's just amazing to me that they can't see that if there's that kind of correlation with all those diseases, maybe there's causation, you know, maybe there's causation.
Maybe.
Think that.
Just maybe. all right. I'm going to stop there because we could go on for any number of hours. That was really great. Thank you so much. Spooky and great. Always my favorite.
I know. I hope there will be a silver lining and we'll come out of this in some kind of better shape than we are right now. But
I am fantasizing the government sending out everybody a bottle of vitamin C. Let's just start there. Like, oh, wow, let's try that. No harm, no foul. All right. Thank you so much, Stephanie. That was great.
Thank you.
And everybody have a great rest of the weekend and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.